Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. We got the whole gang here and big plans for the future. We're not going to say much about them because we're still like in the planning phase, of course. But yeah, we're here back again, all the three of us, Vansh, Owen. How you guys doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Good to have the three of us back here again. And, you know, some stuff has happened since the US Open and tennis is fun as usual. So happy to be here.
Yeah, about the same here. This is usually the time of the calendar when I get really burned out, so I'm feeling that a little bit, but yeah. Excited to be here as well.
Yeah, it's a funny feeling. I remember like last year, right after the US Open, we were just sort of like talking about like how the ATP finals are just like, is this really worth it watching or something? And then by the time that it comes by, we're just like, oh my gosh, it was so awesome. Like the matches are great. It just kind of always feels that way. But yeah, and I totally get the feeling. And I think it doesn't help that Roger Federer and Serena Williams both have tried like back-to-back like in weeks essentially, so it almost feels like tennis is over in a sense, like in general it just kind of needs a hard reset. But yeah, we are actually here to talk about Roger Federer retiring and just like his career, his influence in sport, and ourselves as tennis fans or club players, and Vansh probably as a junior. Yeah, what do you guys take first impressions on his retirement announcement and everything like that?
Yeah, so you know, there's probably a lot of words that won't do justice to, you know, what he meant for tennis and his legacy, just in terms of really being an iconic figure in sports. But I guess just for me personally, he's been a massive reason of why I'm in tennis in the first place. Like just a massive reason of why I started playing, why I started watching, why I started following this game, why I played the juniors. A lot of it was just watching Federer play. You know, like I really don't know a world without Roger Federer just because he's been around for so long, right? He's been around been a pro since 1998. Mostly been a fan for the second half of his career, which is in the 2010s. But nonetheless, he started off this massive era of what we call the big three, and of course big four as well with Murray in there. And you know, for a while there was a period in the early 2000s where there were so many new world number ones, right? So many new players winning majors, and sort of we didn't really know who the next king was going to be, right? Because you had obviously had Sampras and Agassi dominant for a while, but then there was kind of a period in between where you thought Federer might be the guy, but he was But not many people really did, because there was a lot of talent and there was a lot of tools that he had. But he didn't quite put it all together until 2003. And then, of course, we know the rest is history. But really just him retiring right now, in a way, it kind of feels right. But it also just hit me really hard in the moment, just because, yes, he hasn't been around a lot since 2020. And, you know, his knee hasn't cooperated with him. And he even just as early as this Wimbledon, right? When he was there at Wimbledon for the centennial thing, like the 100 years celebration, when he was there, he said, you know, that he hopes to play next year. So at that point, I was still thinking, okay, he's gonna probably give it a go, and maybe next year will be the farewell at Wimbledon or some other place. But the fact that he then had another setback, I think after that he was like, it's time now. Like, and then you know, at first when he was announcing at the Labour Cup, I had like a mix of emotions, because I was thinking, you know, obviously it's really tough, especially just processing all of the news. And then also just, you know, I just the fact that he wasn't playing Basel, I think that was really telling. And in a way, I'm kind of glad that he ended it here now, because of what the occasion was, right? Just because of all the scenes that we saw with all the big four being there. It was just the most perfect, iconic way to end your career. I can't think of a better way or the outcome. It doesn't really matter to me that they lost the doubles match or that he had match point in his last match, didn't win. Like, I don't, all that stuff doesn't really matter at the end of the day. It's it was about the celebration. And I think it was such a Federer thing to do. And it just, yeah, it'll stay with me forever. Like that last Friday that we saw, those images that we saw of Federer and Nadal sitting on the bench holding hands, but Djokovic also behind them,
yeah,
you know, consoling Federer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, him in tears, his family in tears, his agent, his, you know, his kids. You know, the part that really got me was also when he was hugging his kids and he was crying and he was saying, "I'm not happy. I'm really happy and I'm not sad." And, you know, he was just, yeah. And then of course, you had the whole, you know, this send off that he got with just all of his rivals and his tears. Like, who else gets that kind of send off? Like, who else has that kind of impact in sports? It's just, you know, he's one of those that just transcended the game, like LeBron and Tiger Woods and all the other iconic athletes, like in all the other sports. So,
yeah.
I probably talked way too long, but
no, you're all good. It's funny, Vansh. I think I share some of your emotions, but I think in some other ways, my reaction sort of contrasted with yours. Like, for those who don't know, Federer was how I got into tennis. The first major I watched was the 2016 French Open, where he didn't play. But I think my fandom kind of went off a fair bit at Wimbledon that year when he had a run to the semis, beat Cilic in the quarters, saving some match points. So I was like a head over heels fan of his for a while. But then I think in 2020 and 2021, when I was becoming an even more intense fan of tennis and when he didn't really play, I felt like I sort of had time to process his retirement before it happened in those years. And since I hadn't been into tennis for that long, I mean, that was like almost half of the time, not almost half, but like 2 years out of the 4, 5, 6 that I had been a fan. And so I think for me, that was enough time to kind of process it. And so I felt a bit weird because I don't think I really felt the emotions from Laver Cup in a way that others seemed to. Like I the moment with Nadal was incredibly sweet. You know, shout out to Ella Ling for some of what will surely go down as like some of the best sports photography ever, because those images were incredible. But yeah, like I couldn't cry about it. I thought it was amazing to have the big four there, but I don't know. I think something about the emotional state I was in just didn't line up exactly with the moment. Like, Vansh, you said it didn't really matter to you that he lost or that he lost from a match point up. I wish I could have felt that way, because during the match I was thinking, like, I'm really having trouble imagining them losing this and I really want them to win. But then when they lost from a match point up, I was like, that's just tennis, you know? Like, of course the scoring system is going to be that cruel even in a moment like this, because that's just how it is. And so I thought about that for a while. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to take me some more time to sort of sort through how I feel, because I'm not really sure yet.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy how, like, the only thing that I thought about, like, his doubles match was how sadly on brand with late years Federer he was to lose from match point down on his own serve. But yeah, it was a sad moment, like, as in, like, we would wish that he could serve this one out, but like unfortunately it wasn't to be. But honestly, like, 2022 Federer, who hasn't played since getting bagel by Hubert Hurkacz last year at Wimbledon, was not the same who almost beat Djokovic in 2019.
Yeah, but can we talk about that a bit? Like, consensus was sort of that, like, he carried Rafa during this match. He was so nervous that he was missing all kinds of easy shots, and Federer on one leg was actually the better player.
Which is pretty impressive. I thought that as well. Rafa was so tight, right? He was missing a lot of easy volleys. He was, and you know, it's very understandably so, right? Like, we have to say, like, Rafa basically just came for Roger in this tournament because
he left the next day.
Personal stuff at home and with his, you know, his wife is pregnant right now. And of course, we don't know the details of that. We don't need to, but essentially, he just came for Federer's farewell. So I thought, considering all of that, I don't even think he was at full fitness or anything like that. So he, I think, by far was the most nervous of all the players.
It was, and
Federer actually, you know, when he was connecting with the shots, like, you know, he didn't miss too much. Like, he was hitting
his volleys were good, man.
I mean, he can still serve on one leg. He can still serve all four corners of the box. Like, it's just amazing. Like, I mean, he hit that ace at what, 5-all in the super tiebreak. He hit some other like forehands. Like, when he was connecting, the movement is not anywhere close to where it was in 2019. I think probably that forehand that he missed on match point, he probably would have made that in 2019. But the reason why I wasn't so upset is, like, I was happy he just finished the match and he was able to play without any getting injured in between, you know, like, nothing major happened. He was able to finish it and it was, Yeah,
it was a good competitive match as well. So that's kind of fun. Yeah. That he wasn't,
I think,
like,
if you were just there for the tennis, if you were just there for the tennis and not the stuff at the end, you would have liked it as well. Like, it was.
Yeah, for sure.
One of those matches.
Yeah, and Vance, you touched on this a bit, but like, it's so remarkable to me that, you know, the four were there and the three were there, and that, like, you know, Djokovic on the sidelines, who I think probably could have looked at this as like, my God, you know, I'm still the third wheel after all of this. And like, he was into it too. Like, he was rooting for them. He was emotional at the end. Like, Nadal was emotional. And I think it's important to stress, like, so Federer and Djokovic have never really been that close. Federer and Nadal, like, the bromance has been talked about for a long time, but like, as recently as 2014, Nadal is like, yeah, I mean, we respect each other, but like, we're not friends. We're not best friends. And like, a lot has changed. Like, these guys are, Federer and Nadal are like really good friends now. Like, I think Djokovic is getting to a place where like, he could call himself friends with both of them. And given the history they have between them, it's remarkable. Yeah. I don't know how it's possible. And I'm really happy we got it.
Yeah, and speaking of history, like, you said that you couldn't connect, and because like, you've been following tennis since essentially like 2016. Like, I remember, like, for me, like, as a kid and like learning tennis and just kind of getting into it, like, was basically 2007, essentially prime Federer years, and Nadal literally just kind of getting up there. I watched the 2008 Wimbledon final live. It was phenomenal. That's all you could talk about in the club the next day. It felt like a time, like an era changing moment. And sort of was, sort of not, wasn't, but like, it was definitely a big match. But it, you know, like, growing up, it felt like tennis was synonymous with like Federer in first, Nadal being second, and Djokovic being third. And they all chasing Federer. And it just kind of feels off, just kind of Federer not being there. But I guess like a lot of, and I just kept thinking like of all the people that came back in the past, like the fans of tennis of like the 70s and 80s and 90s, will have to like see this time and time again. And it's obviously like something that I felt like, man, it's just like, tennis is changing for me as well. Like, it's just kind of interesting, kind of not relying on the players so much anymore, but like really just kind of like seeing this board and like what's going to happen. And I guess it helps a lot in terms of fan bases as well, because I guess people can kind of look past that and start enjoying players as they're playing. And hopefully it's going to be the case. Not saying that Nadal should retire, but like, when Nadal decides that it's time to call it a career, maybe things are going to get a little bit better. And for Djokovic as well, like when he goes by. And I think Djokovic,
this was the most united I've seen big three.
Ever. And honestly, the fact that the four of them were there, and like Djokovic, especially Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer were there, and just kind of like cheering each other up and like kind of giving each other tips on how to play. It just really has a huge contrast of like, they don't necessarily care on a foundational level, on a fundamental level, about like who's the best between all three of them. Like, they're competitive guys, obviously. Like, they're the most competitive a tennis player can be in history, right? But it doesn't mean that they can't be friends, or it doesn't mean that they have to be disrespectful towards each other. It's just, at the end of the day, you kind of feel like that dude bro vibe, and the signs on it is like, yeah, and like, it's just like playing sports, right? It just kind of have those raw emotions. It's,
I think,
just
that's what's
fun.
So great about the three. Yeah. Like, they're able to separate the two things, because like, they understand that at the end of the game, tennis is just a game, right? Like, it's just, like, we're competing for these big prizes, but at the end of the day, like, we're colleagues, and we're in the same job, and we're like, we see each other, and we've seen each other, and we've made each other better over the years, and we wouldn't be where we are without the other two. So I think that mutual respect is at least there. Like, Djokovic and Federer haven't really ever been that close, but I think they always had that mutual respect, understanding for each other, in terms of, and especially, I think they can also connect on a deeper level because they're fathers of kids. And I think that's what Djokovic really said got him really emotional the next day, right? It was that seeing his kids and seeing Mirka and seeing that, because he can relate to that with he's on Federer's level in terms of relating there. And I also think, just like, it's kind of fitting, I think Federer said it himself, that he's the one that goes first, because he said it just wouldn't have felt right if, for example, like, he was really scared, for example, in 2019 when Murray almost retired because of his hip, and now he's obviously carried on, and he's playing tennis, and he's doing well, all things considering. But like, I think it's fitting, like, that it ends right here, to be honest.
And I honestly like the Laver Cup and the format. he really proportionated the moment that he had. And I was just like watching the Laver Cup this time, and we always like, not to kind of like draw a tangent towards like the Laver Cup at this point, but like while the Laver Cup has a bunch of weird problems with like whatever, some people don't really like the format, some people don't like that it's actually counting as like official events for ATP, but all of those things don't necessarily like, of all the Laver Cup problems, none of them is tennis related, which is a good thing. Like the tennis is really awesome. It's just like,
yeah,
it's just for the history books in a sense, that just kind of like, we wish he wasn't really there for a few reasons, but and some of the formatting in the sense that like maybe World versus Europe isn't the best way to go about it. And there's a place for women as well to compete and it would be really fun. But you know, like the quality of tennis and the fact that he proportionated such a great moment with like the big three, and everybody really cares about the event, which is like crazy to see, like how Team World actually,
yeah, they want to
so
win badly.
Yeah.
Like because they don't want to let their teammates down, and you throw five or six people on the same bench and you're playing for them. Like it's like this added weight and pressure that you feel. And you know, you see players get tight in super tie breaks. Like, and just look at the last match between Tiafoe and Tsitsipas.
Yeah.
Like hosted for World, right? Like it was tight because they don't want to let their team down. And it's like, and then I just love the way they it feels almost like who was saying this on Twitter? Gil Gross was saying it, that it almost feels like a mini Netflix series, because you're stripping away all those barriers and all those limitations to access that we don't get in the other tournaments. And you have this amazing feel of like amazing camera angles, amazing like directing, like you know the players in the players, you can, they're all mic'd up, you can hear everything that they're saying on the you know, with them coaching each other, and you have like these bits of like content that are just social media gold, right? Because you see them and they're shared all over the place. Like anything that you tweeted in the last week, like probably went viral.
Yeah, we had I don't know if you guys saw this, it got copyright stricken eventually, but like you know Ollie on Twitter, he posts a lot of points and like media clips. I think he posted the clip of Federer and Nadal crying, and it got like 300,000 likes or something.
I saw it when he got copyrighted, so like, oh man.
And like our mutuals like went viral and stuff. I mean my gripes with the Laver Cup are the way they've dealt with Zverev. Like I think the social media admin blocking everyone who tweeted Olya's story was absurd. I think that continues to be a problem, and I think the ticket prices were a problem this year. Like
that's a big problem.
Very unfortunate. But Andre, I agree with you that like the tennis is not a problem. I didn't notice a difference in the level of competitiveness between this and official matches.
Yeah.
And to have the comedy at the same time is great. Like one that sticks with me is you know, after Djokovic was just destroying Tiafoe in the first set, who was on a great run of form, and you know, Djokovic like literally playing as well as anyone can, and Federer on the bench is like, you know, Djokovic, your Novak, your rally tolerance is so great to see, keep it up, and Djokovic just says thanks, and it's like that's a video clip, that's amazing. So I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Oh yeah, and then of course I remember there was another one. Yeah, Djokovic was an awesome coach this week.
Yeah.
I mean, there was the match when Murray and Dimitrov were playing each other, and he's like, Andy, focus on the quality of your own shots. You know, don't worry about what Alex is doing. You know, you know how he's going to play. Just focus on your strengths. Play up to your game. And I was just like, and then right after that, Andy breaks and he holds and he wins the set. And it's just like, wow, like you know what I mean? This is golden. There was a bits for Federer as well. Nadal, like you know, there was some comedy when they were playing doubles, and Nadal was like, I just have no feel. I have no control. Like, you know, and it was such a great experience to see like Casper Ruud there as well. Like, and Tsitsipas, I think they can take some of these experiences and really learn from them. Like what's better than this for like a weekend, I feel like.
Yeah.
And I think it also shows like, you know, personal issues between players aside, like, If Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic can be friends with each other, like it feels like any rivals can be friends, right? Because these guys played matches against each other that like changed tennis. You have these 5-hour wars. You have blown match points. You have choked leads. You have like wins from two sets to one down. You have like major
streaks
finals,
broken.
Record like, shattered. Like everything.
40, 50, 60 matches played against each other, and like Federer and Djokovic are like laughing about the 2019 Wimbledon final in press. Like Djokovic brings it up and Federer doesn't go, screw you, Novak, and storm out of there. He laughs. Like that's incredible.
Yeah.
I you know, going back through all the archives and stuff, like I've I've seen all of their matches, and you know, maybe watching them in real time was different, but after seeing all of that, I didn't think we would get to the place we got. I just think there's so much tension and emotion and heartbreaking matches there. Like, I'm so amazed they've gotten to where they are now. I'm like proud of them, really. Like,
yeah, seriously. Yeah,
it's times like this when you just realize, like, it doesn't really, honestly, I'm not so interested in anymore in, like, you know, who is the greatest or whatever, in terms of, like, the stats will speak for themselves at the end, but it's just it's more about, like, what they meant to tennis, their impact, like how they made fans feel overall, like how they made each other better. I think those are, like, the better takeaways, honestly, because you're never really going to see a generation like this come again, like with three or four players, like, just over 18 years having won that much and made each other better people as well as better players. It's like, yeah, like they just come full circle. It's, I can't believe it, honestly. There were times last week where I just, like, I can't believe what I'm actually watching. Like, it's,
I mean, you think back to 2012, where each of them won a major. By the end of the year, it was not exactly clear which one of them was on top, and they started 2013, like, basically all fighting with each other. I mean, Nadal injured at that point, so it was more of the other three. But, like, you had phases like that where, like, there, you get a combination of, or, like, you get one of the editions of the rivalry at every single major. Like, they're trying to take each other down, they're trying to build legacies, like, it was just, like, as intense as it could get. And somehow they've managed to separate that from how they feel about each other personally, which is so cool.
Yeah.
And the Laver Cup itself, I think they do a really good job in the format, in the sense, like, even if the teams feel super uneven, like, you still have to win it on the third day, right? Because
the doubles helps, the super tiebreak helps.
And then it's the 3 points on the second day, on the third day. I like that, actually, because it just increases the stakes.
Because the way that they did this, I think it's pretty ingenious, because they have, I think, 24 points up for grabs, something like that. And if you win all of the matches from days one and two, you're still 1 point short of winning. So technically, you could still, like, tie it up, like, winning all four or all of the matches on the third day. So that really makes it, like, interesting in terms of format. I was looking at it the other day, and this day, and I was thinking, wow, this is actually really, like, a really interesting idea to make things, like, competitive up to almost the last second. Of course, like, if they win just the one match, like, on day three, it's kind of done and dusted, but still. But yeah, I think it's Laver Cup aside. Yeah. Don't really have much else to say.
What did we think of Federer's on-court interview after he, with Courier? First of all, Jim Courier is one of the best on-court interviewers in tennis, period. But
I got to be honest, I haven't watched it yet. Yeah. I've been trying to save something. Because it all happening at once was, even though I, like, it didn't totally resonate with me emotionally, it was just such a nostalgia bomb, really, like, everything happening at once. And so I wanted to save something.
Yeah, the thing, I couldn't really watch much of the interview because I wasn't home, so I was kind of watching on my phone. I was supposed to be doing something else, and I got some time to kind of, like, watch just, like, the match point and like the final moments of the tiebreaker, and I watched just a little bit of it because, like, after that they all had, like, a little bit of moment in which, like, Federer just hugging everybody, and then after, like, a solid maybe, like, 15-20 minutes, that's when he hit the interview. So at that point I was already checked out because I had something else to be doing. But yeah, I didn't watch it, but I don't know what happened, like, during the interview from Federer, but, like, I feel like from the interview that I watched at the end of the Laver Cup when Team World won, what it looked like was that they had a very tight schedule. That's for me, like, what it was happening. So I don't know, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but, like, I feel like Courier is really good at, like, putting things forward when he needs to.
I mean, the way he looked the next day was just crazy because he has this really emotional night, the most emotional night of his life. He probably goes to bed at, like, 5 or 6 a.m., right? And he just wakes up the next morning and he just looks like, you know, he just looks back to old goofy Federer again. Like, I just feel like he has this vibe about him that's just, it feels so unreal. Like, I can see why he has this kind of aura, because on the one hand, he feels like just a normal, regular, goofy kind of guy. But then he also has this larger than life type aura where it's like, like, you can just see, like, when he's walking into a room or, like, when he's coming, he just has something. There's, like, a different kind of charm about him just because of, like, what he's meant for tennis, right? but then he has the ability to just like play a ping pong rally with Diego Schwartzman and just, you know, play, just be like his normal self. And I feel like he was able to balance those two things really good. And that's one of the reasons why he's so popular, because he can relate to any person that he speaks to on their level. Like,
Yeah. That's actually one of the points that Christopher Clary brings in his book, the master that he wrote. Like, it was one of the things that Federer really
like when they interviewed him. Like, his interviews were a blast to listen to.
Because he said that like Federer has like this natural curiosity that he makes everybody feel like he really cares about who's talking to, and whatever what people are talking, it kind of feels like he's actually actively listening and actually interested in what you have to say. Crazy to think
about,
right?
Wild, right? Like, you could have the dumbest question ever in a press conference, and he'd give you an interesting answer.
Sometimes.
Like, you could just ask him.
If he loses, he can get a little bit moody, but that's okay.
Yeah. But just in a normal, natural interview setting, right?
Yeah.
Let's say, like, before a tournament or, you know, after a big win or something like that, it feels like he could just give you, like, he could go in different directions that you feel like you didn't think were possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with how, you know, because he's to put it bluntly, he's very rich, right? He has his hands in a lot of pies. He's going to be around tennis for a while.
Yeah.
And so I think he could get away with having like this very like vain, aloof personality, you know, like, you're not my time. Like you're not worth my time. Like, I'm not going to bother talking to you, but he doesn't. Like, he's also the nice guy, like we've been saying. Everyone says they feel good talking to him in the locker room. And I think in those ways, like, all the success didn't go to his head, which is pretty crazy, because he's had a lot of success, like a lot of success, especially in those early years. I think he's a great ambassador for the sport. That's not anything new that people will be hearing for the first time, but
I remember Andy Roddick on, I think it was Andrew Burton who tweeted this, but he said that Andy Roddick said on TC that I absolutely love and respect Roger Federer. I don't say that about many people who ruined my life for a decade.
Right. another tweet that went viral.
Yeah. And then what he added on is, like, for me, it's what he's done when no one is watching. That'll be his legacy. And that's what you were kind of referring to, like with the locker room moments, with those kind of like those conversations with people that he's probably met over the years. Like, could be anyone from like a tournament cameraman or a ball boy to like a.
Speaking of a tournament cameraman, I was just looking for content for Tennis Canada, like a thank you video and whatever. And I was looking for good tidbits and interviews and stuff. So that was one that was it was a post-match interview that he did in Canada, like back in 2006 or four. So he had a long hair, Federer. Like really baby face and things like that. And he was just talking about like how after a match, it's just kind of goofing with the people in the interview room. And he was saying that like a camera guy just kind of like got really close to his face. And he was like, the guy could essentially see like through my ears. And then I was like, and then people was like, oh yeah, it's probably Ryan or something like that, whatever. And he goes like, and they ask, do you have a message for him, Federer? And he goes like, yeah. And he looks dead onto the camera and is like, Ryan, if you ever get this close to me again, boom, he goes like, there's like the motion like as if like it's gonna hit him in the face, and it just starts laughing and just messing up with the people like in the interview. It was just really, really funny about like how he interacts with everybody like on a very like on level. It's like he's like at the same level as everyone, so it's kind of really hilarious.
He feels like a guy you could just go out and have a beer with and just
essentially
like there's that video of him and Rafa just laughing continuously for 45 minutes.
Oh, so good.
Where they're trying to
classic.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to Amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's Amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
do that. And it's like, that was like 2010. I mean, that's like, that's wild. That was 12 years ago. But that's,
What are your favorite on-court Federer moments?
Yeah, I was about to ask.
I mean, if I just say 2017 Australian Open, I feel like that's the most.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's pretty solid.
Kind of, I mean, it's a pretty great answer, one. Like that was one of the Federer wins that I did watch, and that was incredible.
Yeah, for me, it was just how much his game changed during that whole period, right? Because obviously, 4.5 years he didn't win a major, but he was still getting to finals. He was still pushing Djokovic. He was still, you know, after 2013, most people thought it was the end, because you're when you're 30 and you're 31 at that point, and Andy Roddick had retired. A lot of his other rivals from his era had retired. And you were pretty much thinking, okay, this is, he's not the same player anymore. But then he switches to the other racket, you know, 98 inches, and, you know, improves some technical aspects of his game, like his backhand. He starts hitting over it. He, you know, he starts serving bigger. He starts coming to the net. He adds Edberg on his team. And then he goes through all these things, and then he has knee surgery again. And so you're thinking, okay, now this is going to be like one icing on the cake in 2017. But then he really came back. He had this resurgence.
Yeah. He got back to number one in 2018.
He did, and
the fact that he was able to get three majors more after that and get to number one, and be really like in the mix all the way until the end of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Like.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite like Federer moments, and Murray musings have to pardon me for this one, but like 2012 Wimbledon, against when he finally won a Grand Slam again, after I think 2011 he didn't win anything. Yeah, Djokovic dominated it, and then so he comes out and like wins Wimbledon, and another time it was like phenomenal, because he felt like at that point everybody was just saying like, if Federer gets to a semifinal, it's going to be huge already. So like nobody could see Federer winning. And it was at that moment when Federer was, everybody was just saying like he was going to retire very soon. He was past 30 years old. He would have been like 30, 31 or something like that. And of course, like with Djokovic up and coming, like in the best years of his career, essentially. And Nadal obviously like playing really well, having just won, the US Open in 2010, just kind of showing everybody that he could win on every surface in every Grand Slam, just kind of felt like, well, Federer is definitely out at this point. And he, to be fair, like he was definitely third best, like in his, in the past decade, but it's a pretty solid third best to win five Grand Slams. It's still pretty good.
That
Wimbledon just really felt really good to see Federer winning. So, it was like, oh my gosh, he can still do it past 30. And of course, like 2017 happened. It feels like 2012 Federer was a baby.
I also feel like Djokovic is inspired by Roger in the sense he knows, he's seen Roger like play late into his 30s, and he's at this point in his career now, right? Where I feel like he's thinking to himself, I could do it too. You know, I could keep going until I'm late 30s and even hit 40, and it just feels like it's possible. It wasn't like that before.
Yeah. And if Djokovic doesn't get in his own way with these multi-month breaks, like he had this year, like he'll do it too. You see him beat Cilic today?
Yeah.
He's still got it. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, he's just so fresh right now this year because he hasn't missed anything. And during that time he was training, and clearly he's in great shape.
I think in coming first, like, I think Federer pushed the other two to sort of design their games to beat him. And in doing so, like, those two, like, then made Federer improve. And then the three of them just, like, took tennis to this place that it hadn't been before. I mean, like, I will still, like, consistently go back and watch their rallies from, like, that 2008 to 2014 period, where it's just, like, they're inventing new patterns because of, like, the court coverage they have and, like, the angles they would try to hit. It's ridiculous. Like, it still makes me laugh, even after I've seen them, like, dozens of times. What they've done for tennis is hard to put into words.
Yeah, I think it's crazy. Like, when you said, like, they were reinventing, like, the way tennis is played, like, it's 100% that, because how you watch... Just pick any match from between like 2000 and 2002, when like baseline tennis was kind of like on its resurgence. It was becoming the mainstream pattern in tennis, was playing from the baseline. And Federer and Hewitt and Roddick were pretty much the guys who brought this about, and Kirtan as well, like on clay court, kind of made like a little bit more of an attacking style rather than just like rallying. But
it's really interesting, right? Because yeah. The string technology changed during that
period. Yeah, exactly.
Like the Lux Lawn, and I remember Courtin was kind of the first guy to went to it.
But you see those rallies between like Federer and Hewitt, and they feel so slow. Like I feel like it feels like Federer 2017, like on the movement that he was, like 2019, they could smoke them each other out like that easily because they take the ball so much earlier and they just hit so much flatter. And just like sometimes like when they're attacking flatter, but like Nadal, like the addition of like attacking spin to actually accelerate on the ball, not just like miss the net and just kind of like making a neutral rally, but actually using spin as an attacking shot. It's just novelty in the game. Like they really did transform the way that players actually hit the ball and construct the points.
Yeah. One of my favorite ways to kind of observe like the dissonance between like pre-Federer and like Federer myself is like to watch him play Agassi in like 2003 to 2005, because like, you know, Agassi maybe wasn't at his peak then, but he won a major in 2003, he made a major final in 2005, like he was still like beating most players out there. And you watch him play Federer, and Federer makes him look like a junior, because Federer not only like has the huge forehand, which is easily the biggest shot on court, and he has a much better serve, so he can blast Agassi away, but he also defends better. Like he was covering the court in a way who like, and Agassi had a great forehand. Like people would marvel at Agassi's forehand, and like Agassi couldn't hit winners against him because Federer got to everything. So like, you know, sometimes Agassi would like aim for the line and like he'd get a winner, but like it would feel lucky to me when he did that. And like Federer, when he does that, it's just like, you know, how much easy power he has on his forehand. It was like he wasn't even trying. And so you watch these rallies and like Agassi can't hit through Federer, and he can't defend against Federer. And Federer did that to everyone. He just like completely demolished them on offense and defense. Like I think one thing people do forget about him is like how amazing his defense and his passing shots were when he came off, because that was something that Djokovic and Nadal somehow did even better. And I think that obscured how good Federer was at it at first. But like, you know, you watch him play these Wimbledon matches against Roddick, and he's passing Roddick from all these crazy positions, like from anywhere on the court, these ridiculous angles. And, you know, Roddick is frustrated. Like he knows what the problem is, but he doesn't have a backup plan either, because nothing works. And it's just amazing to go back and watch.
Yeah. And then you see the way he's transformed. Like he's came up during the time of the serve and volley years.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he won 2003 Wimbledon, he was serving and volleying quite a bit, and coming forward and playing as well from the back. So he had the power, he had the speed, and he had the touch, and he just had the natural instincts. And then as he went along in his career, during that 2004 to 2010, it felt like he was the best offense. He had the best offensive game and the best defensive game, because you felt like there was just no place on the court that felt safe. Like, you know, you go to his backhand and he'll dice you up with all of his 50 slices that he has. And he literally has that many slices, because he has slices that stay really low and short, and they bring people in, and it forces them to hit a really tough approach. And then he has those flick pass shots with his wrists that he just somehow does on the backhand wing, where he just shortens the swing and you have no idea where it's going. And then, you know, the way he can return your serve and just kind of just dice you up, and then how easily he just made it all look with his fluidity and the way he moved. And it felt at times like he was kind of gliding on the court, right? You see players today and they're sliding all over the place, and they make it look, and it's extremely physical sport, and it takes hours and hours of coordination and training. But Federer was just somehow able to do all of that in this way that just looked, it looked so effortless beyond belief that if you tried to do it on the court, you'd probably make a fool of yourself. And there's still really no one in the modern game, I feel like, who can make it look that simple. You know, put everything together like with that kind of ease. Like there's players who move just as well, who have incredible, who are, you know, efficient in their own way, but not to the way, not perfectly calibrated the way Roger was, in terms of how smooth and effortless it looked.
Yeah, and maybe the smoothness kind of helped him in terms of like remaining injury free in a lot of ways. Of course, like he obviously had the detailed planning and scheduling that he always went through. He was very like careful with his body, but like maybe it has a little bit. It's kind of like a good mix of both. He definitely did like use his talent to the best of his abilities that he could use, because he could have easily just kind of like gone wrong, in the sense that like he could have scheduled poorly, or like, because he suffered injuries as well. Like he wasn't free from that. Like mainly the back, I think, was the thing that bothered him the most of his career up until then.
That
he
was
came
a,
about yeah
an ongoing thing
yeah. But yeah,
like a, but he always took the appropriate time. He always felt like, if
yeah,
you,
exactly.
You know,
so he was
if
very
I miss
good
the
at
next
it, yeah.
couple of months, yeah. so be it. I'll just will come back stronger. And every time he did play, and once he competed, he never wanted to retire. He never wanted to finish mid match. He just sort of felt like, I'll just make the best with what I have, and I'll just.
I do feel like one thing that Federer took a little bit of a while to figure out and become really good at, unfortunately for him, was clay. So I feel like he had this period in his career up until 2004. He was pretty much game. Like, people could beat him at Roland Garros. He would win clay courts, of course, but he wasn't not nearly as dominant as, like, you know, as he was in clay, on grass and on hard courts.
Yeah, I think it was a lot easier early on in his career, especially to get the ball super high up to his backhand.
Yeah.
And also just for him to... You know, he just wasn't as all those other parts of his game didn't really come together.
Yeah.
I feel like
he could not really get the mix of defense and attack properly by that time. But
it was just a little harder for him maybe to finish points, and you know, he didn't necessarily blow you away with heavy power right off of both wings. So it felt like on a clay court, it was more. Even though that's the surface he grew up on and he played, you know, most of his early junior days on, it just felt like.
While we can sort of nitpick him on clay, like the reality is from 2005 to 2012,
He was the second best.
Yeah, exactly.
He was beating everyone not named Rafa. So
I mean, 2012, he lost to Djokovic. 2010, it was Söderling. But the other years literally just lost to Nadal the time he won in 2009. So like, you know, any other era, I'm fully confident he would have won four or five of those things.
I do think that that's the issue, though. Like, by the time that he became good enough to win Roland Garros, Rafa was already better. So, it wasn't a fortunate like turn of events for him that Rafa appeared. But it also was good, as we were talking about, how they made each other better. It just kind of prevented him from making a few more, for adding a few more trophies, I guess, in his trophy room. But
yeah, and of course, the way that he, you know, reversed that head-to-head against Rafa, winning six of the last seven. In the same time, he did lose six of the last seven against Novak, but it just it felt like, okay, he really problem solved here. He found something, and he was able to stick to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, 2017 Australian Open final is the one we talk about, but the 2019 Wimbledon semi was nuts as well. I think like the last two sets he made like five on force errors in total or something. He was untouchable those last two sets against Rafa. You know, like, I mean, that last game, He had two match points, and it all saved them both with winners. There was a break point. Federer 30 all like dumped a smash into the net, and he held serve after all of that. And you know, was a point away from winning that final. Like, I mean, we talk about that because it, to put it bluntly, it was a choke. But the fact that he got so close to winning that tournament at 37 is insane. I gave him no shot going into that final. Gave him no shot going into the semifinal, for that matter. And he nearly beat them both back to back at 37 in long matches. That's insane.
Yeah, I think that just adds to his legacy, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
To come that close, be about 10 centimeters away, like, you know. It's,
and speaking of legacy, like, how about we finish this, like, making a little bit of a list, if you will. Like, what do you guys think was, one, the best match that Federer has played, and two, what his most important match? Because they may not be the same.
On the court, I mean,
this is hard.
You might have lost the best match.
there's too many. But
One that comes to mind for me, I don't think this is the highest quality, but it's one of my favorite ones to revisit, is honestly the 2009 Australian Open final, which sort of gets overshadowed by the 2008 Wimbledon final. And the last set and a half of that match was not very good. But if you watch the rallies that he and Nadal have in the first three and a half sets, it's like they're both on speed. The way they move is insane. I think everyone will remember that famous rally in the fourth set, 2-all deuce. Federer hits a ridiculous squash shot, dead on the run, that like goes flying into the other corner. One of the best shots I've ever seen, and it doesn't even win him the point. he did a lot of good attacking with his backhand in that match. That's one of my favorite highlight rewatches, just because I think those 3.5 sets were peak Federer and Nadal.
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, there's been some times where he's just made really, really good opponents look inferior. Like early on in his career, I mean, obviously the 2004 US Open final against Hewitt. You watch that, it's like 6-0, 7-6, 6-0.
Yeah.
And Hewitt is, you know, still playing really good tennis at that time and still looks like he can challenge Federer and, you know, still had a head-to-head edge over him. And Federer just goes in and just absolutely destroys him. Like, it's, you know, to the point where you really felt for Hewitt, because it's like, my goodness, the things that he can do on the court and package it together. And
I liked the 2003 Wimbledon semi with Roddick as well, because I think Roddick was favored to win that one.
Yeah.
And Federer just, like, I mean, first set was close, and after that, Federer just, like, cut him up with passing shots. I think he had something like 62 winners, so like 12 unforced errors in that match. You know, Wimbledon generous with the stats, but that was wild.
Yeah, and I think it just impressed me how many of those close matches that he lost, but he was able to bounce back from, you know, very quickly. Like when he lost the 2008 Wimbledon, finally he was able to win the US Open, get back to number one the following year. When he lost the 2011 US Open semi against Djokovic, he then went on a tear and won, got back to number one a year later and had a really good first half of 2012. There's just so many moments like that where I feel like for every match that he lost with match points, though, there's also one that he won that he probably shouldn't have won. And I think he knows that in his mind. So I think that's what helps him get over some of these, which is amazing. Like, I don't know how he's able to do that.
Yeah.
And sleeps, you know, so, and be so proud, because he can be, but then it's just like, you know, there's so many matches, like the 2009 Roland Garros match against Haas, you know, if that forehand inside out winner was a little bit wide or misses by a bit, he doesn't have a French Open. And then now we could be having a very different conversation about his legacy. So,
I think his most important, I think I have three matches for him with like the most important matches that he's ever played, and in no particular order, like 2009, both finals of Roland Garros and Wimbledon, because those were like the key moments for him to finish like essentially every record that made people say that he was the GOAT. So like tying Pete Sampras, winning Roland Garros, and then surpassing Pete Sampras.
He did that in 6 years. That is wild still.
Yeah.
2003 unreal. To 2009.
Yeah. The Robin Soderling match wasn't incredible, but like the Wimbledon final was pretty solid. Like a really good match that Roddick really played his part really well. And no comments on 2017. We already know about that one. So, yeah, Australian Open final.
The 2009 Wimbledon final might be my favorite, like, individual Federer moment, because that one I watched Wimbledon's extended highlights before I knew the results of the match. I'm kind of watching and they're catching me off, and it's like, so Roddick has won the first set and then it starts playing point by point when he's 6-2 off in the second set tiebreak. And so I was thinking, like, man, Federer's screwed. And then he hits like this flick backhand winner for 6-3, and then he hits two big serves, and then we all know what happens at 6-5. And then Federer wins the next 2 points to win the tiebreak. Just reels off 6 points in a row like it was nothing. Like, stayed calm. And then, like, you know, Roddick sails this last backhand past the baseline. And Federer, you, for a second before the crowd goes wild, you hear Federer go, "Oh, hey," because he's, like, evened the match. And you immediately know, like, I think the commentators even said, like, well, that's probably the few minutes that's going to decide this match. Like, and it was, even though the fifth set was as close as it was. It just amazed me how in control he was.
Yeah,
in control. And then those years in the middle, right, where he just went on these streaks, like 23 consecutive major semifinals, like getting to 18 out of 19 major finals, like just that one loss to Djokovic in 2008 at the Australian Open. Like, that's it. Just one loss in the semis, and he made like 19, he would have had 19 in a row. And then he had like, I think 36 straight quarterfinals. Like, some of these are just never going to be beaten, I feel like, or those 237 weeks consecutively at number one.
Takes a lot of consistency, like more so, like, I would say the 237 weeks at number one consecutive is just ridiculous. It's almost insurmountable, like in my view. But I think that the quarterfinals record that he has in the semifinals, it's just mad consistency and versatility, like to achieve that in every Grand Slam that you play, like one after the other without a break, because he played, I think, all of those consecutively. He didn't like It's not like he kind of missed like a Roland Garros.
Yeah, he didn't miss any. Yeah. I mean, 2008 was a bad year for him.
Yeah.
He only won one major.
Exactly.
And only made two other major finals.
Yeah. Like, and then 2010.
That's an atrocious year for Federer.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
I mean, didn't people start talking a little bit about retirement in 2008? I mean, like 2012, I know it came up, which is insane because that's a year where
I know that David Law asked him and after he won 2007 Wimbledon against Rafa.
Oh, God.
He asked him in the BBC, man, throwing David Law under the bus here, but he's like, he's like, so Roger, do you think at the end, do you think you're going to be able to play the 2012 London Olympics?
Oh,
like,
wow.
Do you think you'll be able to play that long?
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, the most striking line in the Master, like Chris Clary's book about Federer, I don't think I have it with me, but anyway, he's talking about winning Roland Garros or something. And I think it's like 2004 or 2003. And he goes like, you know, you saw Pete, you saw Andre, so I'll maybe have like anywhere between like 7 to 8, so like 15 more chances to win this thing. And Chris Clary just goes like 15, and Federer's like, yeah, 15. And he's talking about playing until he's like 38 or something, which was unthinkable at the time. And it's what he did.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's just how much Federer loves the game and how much he did for it. And just to cap it off, I guess my two choices for best matches is played 2006 Rome and 2009 Australian Open. I'm with you on that one. I think it was one of his best matches ever.
This is all the matches that he's lost, which is crazy. Those
are
some of his best.
He's got an amazing.
It just tells how good you have to be.
Yeah, like Federer's catalog of like close losses and like epic matches is unbelievable. Like, and I don't mean this as a slight against him or even necessarily a compliment to Djokovic at all. It's just like the amount of close losses he's had in these amazing matches, like 2006 Rome, like 2009 Australia, 2008 Wimbledon, 2019 Wimbledon, 2014 Wimbledon, like all these matches, like four setters and five setters. It's insane. Like all the wins, all the losses, all the close losses. Like, yeah, he needs multiple books written about his career, I think.
Yeah. I could write a book for every slam that he's played, essentially.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. Just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good place to wrap up. I have to.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, we're wrapping up with Owen's next huge project for his life, writing a book on every single one of Federer's Grand Slams.
It would be fun. I was thinking recently, I mean, I don't know how I would get these quotes, but it would be cool to like talk to everyone, like, I mean, the big four and then like some of the lost gen people and do like an oral history of the 2012 Australian Open, because I feel like that was like peak big four, and get them to talk about like all the matches and the semis and the final and stuff. But anyway, gonna need to wait many years to get that kind of access, I think.
Yeah. Good context, maybe.
Yeah.
Big project, though. I'm all in for it. If I can help you in any way, I will do it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Guys, this was great. Sorry it's been so long. Talk to you next week.
All right. See you guys. It was great to talk to you again. And happy retirement, Roger.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.